to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
The purpose of today's event is really to have a gathering of people who are interested in and concerned about, one way or the other, the impact of the Google Book Search settlement. I want to say a few things about what this conference isn't, though, or meant to be, and then what we mean it to be. So the first thing we're not aiming for here is a Google Book Search 101, the basics, right? There are lots of other wonderful conversations about that on the wiki, lots of great commentary about it. James Grimmelman has a wonderful site devoted to this. Siva's done great work online and so forth. There's a fair amount said about the basics. It's also not meant to be Google Book Search pro and con in the sense of let's kind of have a debate about whether or not it's a good thing so much. And it's not also meant to be Google Book Search let's scuttle the settlement. That is also happening. Lots of people are working on this one way or another. Others, I suppose, are supporting it. It's not to say we can't talk about those things, but that's not the gist of what we're trying to do today. And of course, you know, shape the contours of the day as you see fit, but that's sort of not our emphasis. The emphasis is instead to say that those of us who are queasy about or skeptical about the settlement, I think, have a particular challenge on our shoulders, which is to say, what do we think would be better? And from my perspective, there really is sort of a decision tree, invoking Charlie Ness, and he would be talking right now, if he were doing this welcome, about the rhetorical space in which we are operating. What's going on in this rhetorical space? And it seems to me there's sort of a decision tree in this rhetorical space. One angle of the decision tree goes up toward, if the settlement is approved, what then? What should we do? And it seems to me there are lots of different possible things that one could do at that point. An example would be to say, okay, we know, having focused on this, that we care a lot about orphan works, and we're worried about what will happen with respect to orphan works if the settlement becomes law, and therefore we should talk about orphan works legislation, for instance. That would be a way to think about that angle of the decision tree. Another branch, or the other key branch of the decision tree, is to say, if it doesn't go through, if it's scuttled one way or another, the judge decides not to approve it, what then? We have a do-over, and what would we do with a do-over? I think many of us have a sense that we wish we had this to do again 5 years ago. We wish we had done this ourselves somehow as the public interest community. We didn't, and now, you know, we're sort of facing the consequences. And so that seems to me the other angle of the decision tree. So for today, the idea is to have both of these possibilities on the table, not presuming one or the other, but really trying to reflect on all of this interest in this settlement. To me, comes from the fact that many of us are worried about this, and it has brought out of us concerns about the future of information in digital age, the future of books, the future of how private law is made on top of public law, and so forth. These very big issues that we didn't focus on enough, blaming myself as much as anyone else, a few years ago. And so there's a question really of what now? What do we want to do? Are we going to come together and build this ourselves in the spirit of the Internet Archive, which is just plowing ahead and doing its thing? Are we going to go down to Congress and focus in a way we haven't as much on orphan works legislation? Are we instead going to focus on some other aspect of this that has really come to the fore, digitizing our own collections, if you're thinking in terms of a library or thinking about our services quite differently and so forth? So that's really the overall frame of today. It's to talk about the possibilities, whether or not the settlement goes forward. That's not to say you're banned from talking about whether you like the settlement or not. Of course, that's much in the conversation here, and I think we should be guided by our instincts in reading this 200-page, incredibly complicated document and all the conversation that that comes from it. So that's the overall gist of the day. Let me pause there before we go hurtling into the first session, see if anybody wants to talk about the frame and the overall arc of the day. The entire schedule is on the wiki again. It will be adjusted over time if we need to adjust. Phil Malone?
Let me just throw out a nugget to get you started now before we get into the substance, which is this afternoon we'll be having much smaller breakout sessions. There are three sessions that are more or less pre-programmed, which we can walk away from if there's not interest, but we also hope that you will construct your own to the extent there are things you really want to talk about that we're not covering a group that you want to get together to focus on some aspect of this, would be thinking through the discussion this morning about whether there are specific topics you would like to address with a smaller group. And when we come back from lunch, we'll have a short pitch session where anybody who wants to do a session can stand up and take 45 seconds or so and tell everyone what you would like to talk about, try to recruit them to join you. So be thinking about that between now and then, and if you have a great idea, by all means, bring it to everyone and we'll do something this afternoon.
And those are the only time when we won't be webcast, right? For those who are watching, it's just logistically impossible, not meant to be constraining the outside participation in the session, right? Okay. Excellent. So I think with that, we'll just leap into the first session and obviously interrupt as we go. I'm joined here on the dais, as it were, or the front of the classroom, by two quite wonderful people who've been doing great work in this area, and we've asked them really to do the beginnings of the conversation to help get us started and then do this conversationally as well. The idea for this session is to focus on the opportunities that we should be seeing with respect to this settlement, to talk about what a truly open digital collection might look like, the potential utopia or possibilities in that way anyway, and to think about what would it be like if it in fact were run by major libraries or run by people focused on the public interest, and what we can learn from the many players who are doing great work in this space, Open Content Alliance, Internet Archive, Human Knowledge Project, and so forth. That's the overall gist of this opening session, and to lead us in that respect, we have two great panelists. Maura, who's going to go second, is the executive director of the Open Knowledge Commons, someone I've come to know and respect greatly in the last year. She is a librarian by training, but she has lots of other great experiences as well, and she has been directing what is effectively a startup nonprofit, the Open Knowledge Commons, which I'm sure she'll talk more about and tell us about. I happen to be a board member, so by way of disclosure, I'm very fond of, someone who I think everybody knows very well from this business, Siva, and I am terrible at saying his last name, but I'm going to try, and Vaidyanathan. All right, I finally got it once. I've heard it said 12 million times, 12 million different ways, and I've been really fretting about this moment where I had to utter it myself in front of a lot of people. He gave me a little help. Siva is someone who I think many of us have read his work for a long time and been deeply impressed by his insight in this field. He was at in New York for a long time. He's now at the University of Virginia. To lead us off, Siva, the floor is yours.
Thanks, John. You can always pronounce my name Cassandra if you prefer.
Now I know.
I mean, I'm sort of here to say I told you so, but not as a critic of Google Book Search or of Google, which you know I'm certainly on the record as being in a lot of ways for the last 5 years. But more, I told you so as a Yankees fan who's tired of the self-righteousness of Red Sox Nation, because I knew that Big Poppy was juicing. And I'm so glad I can say it to, and Manny, of course, but I was more interested in Poppy. I'm glad I could say it to the universe through CNBC. So,
and in Boston, of all places.
Exactly. So, yeah, no one is pure, despite George Mitchell's best efforts. So, anyway, we're going to have some deep exploration today of the various ways we might imagine our information ecosystem over the next 50 years. And we do that, of course, with great consideration for the giant actor in that field, which is Google. Google's mission, Google's explicit corporate mission, is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible. That's a pretty stunning mission. That's a pretty bold mission, and one that as far as I can tell, doesn't sound anything like the mission of any other firm ever in the history of the world, with the possible exception of the university in which we sit. And I think that's an important contrast, right? Although actually it was to train the clergy of New England, right? Isn't
something
that
still like that.
Still its mission?
How many clergy here?
Yeah. Google Book Search is an example of what I call public failure. Public failure is in stark contrast to market failure, which is a phenomenon we're much more familiar with, right? So The market doesn't adequately support bluegrass or opera, and so, or for instance, public news broadcasting. And so in the 1960s, using a market failure argument, the United States embarked on an experiment with public broadcasting. As you know, by the early 1980s, market failure arguments sort of fell to the side, and even institutions, public institutions like public broadcasting, prisons, and the military suddenly had to make market-based arguments for everything they do and increasingly invite market players in to do the job that the state was supposed to be doing. So public failure is essentially a vacuum created by either the negligence, incompetence, or the necessary slowness of public institutions, right? Often the important slowness of public institutions. There are so many things that are ostensibly in the public interest, like maintaining prisons, like maintaining a military, like maintaining open information and access to knowledge, that we had grown so accustomed to in the history of this country that we sort of took it for granted as arguments for the public and for public funding of important things became almost rhetorically absurd, almost uninvited into the public stage, again, beginning in the early 1980s and really hitting an apex at the beginning of this decade itself. And so what we see with Google Book Search is an almost predictable state. We finally have reached the point where we have both the interest and the technological means to deliver massive amounts of the world's knowledge to a large number of people, if not the majority. And that's a pretty remarkable thing in human history. And we're all sort of stunned by it, and we're all trying to make sense of it. We're all trying to make up new rules to guide ourselves through it, make up new norms to make it a little bit more civil. And we're so early in that process that, of course, we're much more frustrated than enlightened by the whole process. And into this gap steps a company that has brilliantly figured out a way to monetize that absence, that vacuum, that public failure. And we seemed so glad to invite this company in to do this. And of course, we're willing to pay for it, right? Because what Google is offering us is not free. Nothing is free, actually. Something I find myself saying a lot these past couple of months. Nothing is free. We pay for it in a variety of ways. We just don't pay for it in a piecemeal way. In one sense, we're paying for it through the donation of the collections that we, the people, have paid for over the past couple of hundred years into a vault controlled by a private entity. You can call that corporate welfare. I have at times. I'm not sure that that's a realistic and full way of examining that transaction. Nonetheless, that is what's happening. We pay for it also through our very activity with that collection. Last summer, we all started asking the question, is Google making us stupid? That was the wrong question. It all depends on what you mean by stupid. The real question is, are we making Google smarter? And we certainly are, right? We are serving it every time we interact with it. And that's not necessarily bad. That's actually a pretty good deal for most of the services that we ask for with Google. And it may actually be a very good deal when it comes to the digitization of vast collections. It may be worth it in that to engage in that transaction. But we have not fully taken account of that transaction. We have not fully taken account of what we give up and what we get. And we have not achieved a level of accountability in this entire system yet. So, what do we do about this? Well, a lot of conversation about Google Book Search has revolved around two very crucial issues, and we're gonna hear a lot about them today. One is competition and the potential antitrust implications of the settlement. And the other is, of course, privacy, which is so often, because it's such a complicated issue, it's often dismissed as, oh, and there are privacy concerns, or, oh, and we must pay attention to privacy, or we must make sure that Google respects our privacy. And of course, Google will respond as it does respond with a mantra. And that mantra is, privacy is very important to Google. In fact, that very phrase you will hear over and over again, you can actually Google that phrase. See the number of times that Marissa Meyer says it in public interviews. Google, privacy is very important to Google. And it is, of course, but it's privacy on Google's terms. So what do we do with all of that? Can we actually come up with a set of standards that any firm, not just Google, would have to conform to or would be urged to conform to? Can we come up with a reasonable set of laws and regulations governing the collection and distribution and resale of our collective expressions of our passions and interests and hobbies and other sorts of search terms, right? Can we come up with a set of standards in, I think, the area that's been understudied, which is actually search, right? What Google does best. Google does web search so well and serves us so well in that, that we haven't fully interrogated just how badly Google does book search. And actually, you got your laptop open, you know, do a search now for a subject you know a lot about and see whether on the first page the three books you think should pop up. And I can pretty much guarantee you they won't. We don't know why one book ranks above another in Google book search. And of course, Google won't say, because Google shouldn't say, it's not in Google's interest to explain how its book search works. We know that in general, web search works based on the principles of incoming links, not only the number of incoming links to a page surrounding a term, but also the weighted power of those pages referring to that page. We know that's the general principle, and it's been the general principle since the founding of the company, but we also know that that's changing. We know that Google is increasingly committed to customizing search. Customizing search means paying attention to what you have already expressed as your interest, as your curiosity, as your desire. Now, customizing search on the web has tremendous implications, and a lot of the book I'm finishing now deals with this notion of the implications of customized search to the greater sense of knowledge, right? Because if my search results are very different than John's search results, well, what are we going to do with that, right? How do we actually engage in conversation? There are a lot of implications to that. But the other thing to think about here is, to what extent will customized search affect Google Book Search? Is that going to be the key to what you come up with? Does that mean you're always going to find books about what you already think about? And is that a very efficient way of doing things? Probably. It's great for shopping. It may not be great for learning. So can we come up with standards about search? Because here's a premise I hope we can all agree to start the day with. The Google of 2009 is not the Google of 2000 and will not be the Google of 2020. In fact, Google might not even exist in 2020. Most companies don't last that long. Google's been around for 10 years now, and it's been a really good 10 years. But who's to say the next 10 years are good? Who's to say that the internet will be the internet in 10 years? Who's to say we'll even use the word internet in 10 years? Who's to say that the web will be the web, that Google will be Google? Who's to say that all of the promises and pledges and nice words about how Google is serving us and doing good for us will matter at all if Google itself doesn't matter at all? Or who's to say that Google doesn't actually morph into a very different kind of corporate animal, one that behaves very differently in a lot of different ways? There's no guarantee. There's no guarantee. So if we accept that companies change rapidly, and for better or worse, public institutions change very slowly and deliberatively, then we might actually say, well, perhaps it's not too late to start a serious conversation about the public investment in our global information ecosystem. Now, I think it should be global. I think it should be public. There's a lot of disagreement about both those concepts, and that's worth having out. So what I'm proposing is a project I call the Human Knowledge Project, explicitly riffing on the Human Genome Project, which, as you probably know, was a publicly funded effort that has been remarkably successful in a very short period of time, largely spurred on by competition from the private sector, right? A very fast-moving creative firm called Celera came up and threatened the notion of public science with a massive effort to privatize, yet make universally accessible, a tremendous amount of knowledge, and the scientists of the world rose up and said, no, wait, we're not going to let that happen. And they went to their respective capitals and coordinated a global effort to make sure that some of the most important knowledge in the world is in fact publicly accessible and not privatized, even if it's lightly privatized in a way that actually is useful. And the Celera database is actually quite useful. There's nothing wrong with a company doing what's good for a company, but let's not pretend that a company is doing what's good for us in all cases. So the Human Knowledge Project, I see as a 50-year umbrella effort. 50 years. I don't actually expect to be around by the time the Human Knowledge Project reaches its conclusion. Maybe I will be. Who knows? If the Human Genome Project takes off, maybe I will be, right? But that's not the point. It's not about me, right? It's about 12-year-olds in South Africa in the year 2075 being able to get the same level of knowledge and information that a 12-year-old in the United States can get now. And for that matter, who's to say the United States is going to be the United States by 2075, right? So if we're serious about universal access to knowledge, if we're serious about leveling out the discrepancies in access to knowledge and information across the world, it is going to take a 50-year plan. It's going to have to be a global plan. And it's going to have to take seriously re-engineering copyright, re-edifying a sense of privacy. It is going to involve a rhetorical and political effort, of an explicitly political effort, to show the world that this must be done publicly and openly. It must have nodes that exist in the real world and not purely virtual. In other words, real buildings that we like to call libraries have to be the essential nodes of this of this distribution system.
It has to build librarians. Well done.
Exactly. Yeah. It has to build on the values of librarianship as well, which have been well honed over the past two centuries in this country and around the world. Right, we're not the only country with librarianship at this level of professionalism, and so that's what I'm outlining in the concluding chapter of my book, The Human Knowledge Project. So if Google is changing, and Google is changing, we can't count on it. We should not count on it. We can only count on ourselves. I think we did make a mistake 10 years ago by not getting together in rooms like this and making explicit plans over 50 years, because we would be in a better position now to react to the opportunities and great service that Google does provide, and there may be ways to fold in what Google does to a human knowledge project. But it's not too late. It's never too late. Thanks.
So, Siva, I think you got just right the spirit of the day. I think just to underscore that this was exactly where we want to go, a sense of drawing upon the lessons from this experience, but then also pointing ahead to something that, in fact, we could do. And I think pointing out rightly so that in either of these futures, where it's approved or not approved, it's not game over for doing something big and ambitious that we ought to do anyway. It may be more or less difficult, which we should talk about, but I think it's extremely helpful, and I hope the Human Knowledge Project will not only make its way onto your bookshelves in the form of the last chapter of Siva's new book, but also will be something we talk about over the course of the day. So thank you, just terrific. Following that, Maura, you have a hard job, but I know you're up to it. Maura Marks from Open Knowledge Commons.
Thanks, John, and thanks, Phil, for asking me to be here. I do have a hard job, but I think I'm going to jump directly into the practical. I come from this organization, the Open Knowledge Commons. We grew out of the Open Content Alliance, and we're funded by the Sloan Foundation under their program Universal Access to Knowledge, which also funds Wikipedia. So we're dedicated, in a broad sense, to helping create the universal access digital library. But what that means in practical terms for our first year of operation is we're really trying to help libraries define and work on ways to use digital technology to create the broadest possible access to their collections. So I was told that I could speak kind of about the opportunities that there are for us now and look at some of the lessons that we've learned from working with the Internet Archive and the Open Content Alliance and other open projects. And because that's where I have my experience, I'm going to come straight into that practical sphere. and I'm going to try to use the word Google under 5 times. So I think, oh, well, here goes the first one. I think the first thing we've learned in trying to work not with Google but alongside or despite of the Google Books project is that we just weren't able to keep up. You know, we were trying very hard to emulate what Google was doing, and we were trying to do mass digitization across institutions, and we just were not able to get the resources together to compete. And so, you know, we were doing this thing imperfectly. Then the other part of that is that if we look at the Internet Archive and Gutenberg, they're really still digitization projects rather than digital library projects. They don't incorporate even full-text search across the collections. They don't incorporate any kinds of tools that would foster knowledge and learning and creativity. So the result is we've worked very hard together and we've invested money, and we're ending up feeling underwhelmed by the results of our efforts. So I think that in imagining this open digital library that we want, this framework that we want for the future, we're going to have to focus again on added value. And I thought it would be useful to just kind of run through a small checklist that I made up that's not comprehensive in any way, but that would list other attributes of things that we want in this open digital library. And, you know, we certainly want the ability for our users to download and mix and manipulate content. We can't predict future uses, so I think we just know that we can't restrict the forms of access if we want to encourage the most innovation. And in that same spirit, you know, and we learned this with the Internet Archive, there's all this great content, but we need open data APIs so that innovators can come along and build on top of the content to make it useful in ways. There are groups out there that would love to get their hands on the content in an easy way, and we have to build our system so that that's possible. What we also want to keep working on these multiple shared repositories where we're storing our collections together. And I think we have a great example of this huge first step in that direction with the HathiTrust. You know, HathiTrust is an effort, I'm sure most of you know, of some of the Google libraries. It's 13 libraries together, not all Google libraries. And it started out as a shared preservation repository for Google content and other content. And what's happened is that it is that repository, but the groups that are working on this repository have started working together in other ways. And so they're becoming this very active community that's building tools and really working on better access to knowledge. So that's an important thing. What places like HathiTrust enable us to do as well is fulfill that great promise of what we can do with a huge corpus of all of human knowledge, which is new types of research. So, you know, the settlement talks about non-consumptive research, and I think we want to enable that in a broader way. Right now, the settlement has 2 facilities where that non-consumptive research can be done. And I think we don't yet even know what kinds of applications can emerge from access to all of recorded human knowledge as we know it. On the other hand, I think we want to take advantage of some of the new things that are happening in knowledge creation, and our funding cousins, Wikipedia, come to mind. It's this huge phenomenon. We've seen an explosion in user-generated content, I think.
Just as an aside, Ethan Zuckerman tweeted that it's down. Oddly enough,
no,
yes, Wikipedia, and he took a screenshot to prove it.
Well,
isn't that odd?
That's because it's, what is it, the third most accessed site in the world, or the fifth most accessed site in the world, and that alone tells me we have something to learn from them. You know, people are going there and using it as a resource. And there have been some interesting collaborations with user-generated content. I think, again, most of you probably are aware of the Library of Congress Flickr Commons project, which was a great example of how to work with users to actually enrich the data that we have about our collections. Library of Congress released some of their photograph collections into Flickr Commons and then let users kind of work over it and add data. So users benefited, and the Library of Congress benefited by getting better data. So that's another thing that I think our ideal environment will have. But whatever framework emerges, and Siva spoke to this, you know, we have to continue to provide that trusted environment that protects privacy, that, you know, even if it seems like our users don't care so much about that at times, the intellectual freedom that we simply enjoy has to be a central underlying feature of our work. Now, there are some efforts underway that are making progress in some of these areas, and I think that, you know, we would make a mistake if we would think that we could stop and architect out the perfect system that's going to cover everything. I think we have to make the kind of incremental progress that will allow us to keep doing what we do.
Can I just say, are you saying Siva's wrong about the Human Knowledge Project?
No. Okay. I'm going to say that Siva's right about the Human Knowledge Project in some ways. The example I want to give is the Biodiversity Heritage Library Project. I know some folks are here that are working on that. And what that project does is it's a collaborative digitization project where libraries and museums are working together to digitize the biodiversity literature. But they're doing it in a meaningful context. And they're doing it within a context of the Encyclopedia of Life project, which is a great big taxonomic database that is listing every name the known species on the planet. And so the content's over here, the database is here. The content incorporates tools that are developed by a specialized knowledge community, by scientists, to make it more useful. So they have a tool called Taxon Finder that searches through all of the literature and then can create connections to the taxonomic database. So users are in the database, they can discover a term, go directly to passages and books that relate to that term. So not only that, but BHL, or the Encyclopedia of Life Project, also incorporates specialized knowledge communities, so registered scientists can add data to this project, and regular old users can add data to this project. And what's resulted from that is a really thriving knowledge community that's built around a body of digitized content and around knowledge, around this database. And I think the lesson that I take from that is that can become a node on a network where we may see these interconnected nodes that are subject areas, perhaps. You know, maybe it's one way that we can work. And we at Open Knowledge Commons are working on a proposal right now to do a similar thing in the history of medicine, because we think that would be another very rich subject area, and we've got some of the great history of medicine collections working together to try to digitize and then create a great knowledge environment around that. So I think, you know, content alone, great, but we need to create circuits between specialized knowledge communities, our user communities, new applications and tools that will enhance that knowledge to create these nodes on the network. You know, I'm not going to talk today about any of the big policy issues, because I think I looked at the list of who's here and thought...
You, like me, were intimidated?
A little bit. I thought that's probably covered. But I do just want to say that, you know, we do already have, we're so daunted in some ways by the size of Google, but there are things that we have. And we have the attributes of trust. We know that users come to us for trusted information. And we have authenticity. We have these things. We can build on these things and create that incremental progress towards what will be in the future. But, you know, I don't see us making this huge leap overnight. So those are my thoughts for now.
Thank you, Mark. That's very helpful starting point. I want to give Siva a chance to react to this and then to open things up. But let me just ask you a follow-up question, but want to ask the group a question first. So how many people here are involved one way or another in being one of these nodes that Maura talks about, in the sense of digitizing some amount of the world's knowledge somehow, through a library or otherwise? Okay, there are many dozens of these, right? So Maura, here would be my critique of, or I suppose it's in the spirit of clarification. But what you just described of saying we shouldn't design some huge thing that falls under its own weight, letting the imperfect be the enemy of the good and so forth, we should focus on a highly distributed process of digitizing a bunch of the world of knowledge in these different discrete projects and then focus on the things like open data APIs and full text search. Why isn't that simply what we're doing, right? Isn't that, I mean, I think I could imagine channeling Alex McGillivray or others from Google and saying, perfect, that's exactly the story. We're doing a bunch of stuff over here. You're doing a bunch of stuff. Everybody who raised their hands are doing a bunch of stuff. Build on top of it, and that's the internet. Why isn't that exactly the world we live in today?
Well, I think we reacted, first of all, to what was happening with Google, and we, you know, we wanted this broad access, we wanted this thing to happen, but we were trying to keep up with it. And so in trying to keep up with it, we focused over here, and we have limited resources. I mean, I think, and I'm just proposing that as a possible path forward, and who knows, that can change in 6 months. I can have a totally different opinion at that point. But what I've seen is that, you know, you can create these communities, you can create a compelling narrative. It's better from a funding perspective to go with a story that says this is the knowledge that we're going to create, rather than to say we want to keep up with them and we want to scan all of these books, all this stuff. So there's that. And
it's a better argument, so I get that.
It's a better argument. But I also think that by creating these communities, we open the door to incorporating the other content that we have. We're talking about books here today. And we know that human knowledge is recorded in all kinds of things, in manuscripts and letters and all kinds of holdings in our collections. And how are we going to face that problem if, you know, if we're still over there trying to mass digitize books? And we've seen that we just don't do it well. So
Siva, what's the difference between what Maura's talking about and what you're talking about?
Yeah, there is no difference, because I'm talking about an umbrella that can help coordinate and accomplish much of what the variety of experiments that Maura's describing are after. Now, of course, none of those experiments have reached critical mass to the point where they in any way fold into the public consciousness about what's available in terms of information and research. They're certainly not on the minds of my students, and as I've said, though, my students are not the goal here, right? My students are plenty information rich. None of those projects have necessarily a 50 or 100 year time frame. None of those projects move the big mountains we need moved. Now, one of the big things we learned from day one of the Google Book Search project is that copyright is one of the big mountains that needs to be moved. It needs to be re-engineered. It needs to be rethought of if we want to achieve certain goals. And Google pretended to be interested in that. It turns out it wasn't quite so interested in that. And the problem remains, right? And so for any of these projects to achieve the level of fullness and greatness that we hope can actually enrich our planet over the next 50 to 100 years, we have to take that seriously. And that is going to be a much more explicitly political project. We cannot rely purely on litigation, and we certainly can't rely on class action suits to make federal policy. That's the worst possible way to make federal information policy.
And we'll hear more, I think, on that from Larry Lessig for about 20 minutes or so after our break. So Siva, my last question, and then everybody, you're on notice, the microphone's coming out to you, and we're not saying another word until someone asks a question or makes a comment. But what would you say if Google, if I were Alex McGillivray or Dan Clancy, who say, it's absolutely consistent with what you're talking about. Put an umbrella on top of it. Let's reform copyright. Let's go down together and work on orphan works and so forth. And, you know, we're one input to this. Somebody else can come along and do it. Why are you beating up on us? We're part of your human knowledge project.
I'm not actually beating up on Google as much as beating up on ourselves for being satisfied with Google. Uh-huh. That's the problem. We are the problem. Google should do what's in Google's interest every single year. And we are, right? Because we have, and I have to say that major people in the academy, people I respect deeply, 5 years ago said, hallelujah, big rich company here to do our job. And that was not only naive, I think that was close to malpractice. And we're at a point now where obviously we have learned that the future is not quite going to be that bright, and that in fact we can't count on one company to do anything more than what is good for that company. And that's exactly how it should be. And we should count on ourselves and our political institutions and our political movements and our ability to raise public awareness and push forward a program to actually accomplish what we want. And if we want to do it the cheap way and rely on the surplus created by consumer advertising to somehow fund this great project, we are going to be deeply disappointed. That's why we need to think big and long term about this. That's why we need to fund projects like the projects that Maura has outlined today, so they can compete better than a company as big as Yahoo has been competing in web search, right? I mean, look how badly that's going. And so it's naive to think that just because Google does nothing explicit to muscle out competition, that therefore there is competition, right? That is a naive statement. Because Google is more than code and is more than a bunch of smart people. Google is a tremendous investment in infrastructure. It has billions of dollars sunk into the ground, paying for server farms, paying for lobbyists, paying for lawyers, paying for all of the things you need to do this sort of job. That's what we really need to do what's in our interest.
All right, gauntlet is down. 55 minutes till the break. Who wants first at it? And somebody's got a mic running around. Awesome. Great, great, great. Please. And I'd be grateful if you could wait for the mic in the spirit of channeling people into the room who are trying to follow along, and there seem to be a bunch from the Twitter stream.
Thank you. Is this on? Can you hear?
Yes.
I'm Alexa McRae from Harvard Medical School, and I very much appreciated the conversation so far. I think in all cases, we've been looking backward rather than forward, in spite of what you were saying. That is to say, you're looking ahead 50 years and perhaps even further. And I wonder, and I've actually said this before, I wonder if we just declared today as the beginning of going forward, and rather than worrying about the fact that we have many artifacts that we need to continue to digitize, and of course that will be an ongoing process, but rather address the legal and public policy and regulatory issues that we need to address such that our hands are not tied by copyright law, as you've pointed out, and other kinds of regulations, and just declare this the beginning of going forward. Things are going to change as of today. Everything is created in digital format anyway. So let's just do it today.
Sounds right. And I'm not inconsistent with what either of these guys said, I think. Who else? Peter Suber, you are looking pensive in the front row here.
This is Peter Suber from the Berkman Center. It's true, because I was trying to formulate my question, and I haven't done it yet.
Would you like to give it to someone else?
My question is something like this, though. I think Steve is quite right that this is a public failure. This is a job public institutions could have done and should have done. I'm interested in the point that it's not too late. I hope it's not too late. But I'm wondering whether public institutions will think it's too late because Google has this huge investment already in it. How do we persuade public institutions that it's not too late?
If I had a short answer to that, I would be a very rich and powerful person. Because, I mean, look, we haven't even done that with healthcare, right? So this is not by any means easy. But look, if we want something, we have to be willing to do what it takes to get it if we actually want to work through the channels of a democratic republic. If you want to abandon any of those foundations, then fine, we can find some other way to do it. But look, this country built public libraries based on an explicit need for access to information at all levels so a democratic republic can work. This country built public universities for that same reason, at a tremendous rate, with great success in a very short period of time, because I actually think being historically trained at 100 years is a real short period of time. It's been done before. It's been done fairly recently. It might actually get to the point where we can do things again. I mean, I think we're almost at the point where it's pretty clear to enough people in this country that you can't depend on Walmart to deliver the water in a hurricane. As good as Walmart is, that's not the answer, right? So we have enough of these larger arguments to make for this, for the fact that this concept of public failure is intolerable. And I think we have enough of a realizable dream. And actually, Google works in our favor in this sense, because Google has made it realizable. It's made it to the point where we actually expect to be able to find out stuff fast and useful stuff fast. And we also are starting to come to the realization that there are limits to what Google can do for us, because after a while, our expectations will ratchet up higher and faster than even Google can provide for them. which hasn't happened yet, I was struck by the notion that if Wikipedia is down at this time in the morning, there are hundreds of bar bets going unsettled in Eastern Europe right now, right? Because people expect to be able to reach into their pockets and find out the answer, right? So that very ratcheting of expectations can either be our downfall, or they can actually be the momentum generator for forging this sort of effort. But this sort of effort has to be simply explained, has to be clear, and has to identify the need immediately. I'm pretty confident that Google will continue to focus on shopping as opposed to knowing over the next 10 years, and increasingly we will see that gap emerge as bar bets become harder to settle, but buying things becomes easier.
So is Zach Newell in the room?
I am right here.
Awesome. So Zach just tweeted something that I want to ask of you, Siva. So he says, it seems like the issue is who has a stake in the Human Knowledge Project, which I take to be ultimately a political question, and in a way the same as what Peter's asking. Is this any different than all the consumer issues like what Mark Rotenberg's been banging his head against the wall with lots of success, but you know, he's still got all the hair there, and maybe like Larry in Free Culture, where these are topics that concern all of us, but there isn't yet the actual environmental movement that gets all of us doing something together. And especially if, just you make, I think, appropriately this argument, it ought to be a global effort. Doesn't that make it even harder in the sense of diluting yet further the fact that now we need 6.8 billion people on a page and there's not really the political constituency there as against these incredibly powerful corporations, of which Google is but one?
The political constituency in most of the rest of the world is actually pretty strong for a couple of different reasons. First of all, much of the world has a less mature library system to run alongside what Google offers, right? To supplement what Google offers, which pains me to say, I prefer if Google were supplementing what libraries do. But nonetheless, much of the world lacks the level of access that we have, right? So from our point of view, we have a tremendous collective action program problem because we are actually pretty satisfied with what we're getting today compared to what we were getting 5 or 10 years ago, right? But for much of the world, that's not the case. For the same reason that Google sees an opportunity, justifiably, to create a very light operating system for mobile phones that draws on batteries very lightly as being a way of capitalizing on the great opportunity to skip the landline gap in much of the developing world and provide information access directly through a very usable device. That's the sort of opportunity we can have in much of the developing world. I mean, the notion of a human knowledge project does not run counter to what Google's doing, but Google is both an opportunity and a problem within it. Who is it for? Well, it also can serve private interests quite explicitly, the same way that public healthcare can serve private interests pretty explicitly, something they've figured out in Canada years ago, and we haven't quite figured out here yet, right? In the sense that it can socialize the costs and socialize some risks and provide for open flows that make a level playing field for raw material when you're building a company or educating a workforce or any of those sorts of essential services. For the same reason that public schools and public universities once had such a strong constituency.
Larry, are you willing to speak to this from the back row? No? No cold calling? Excellent. Who else? Please.
So I'm interested in the, moving the regulatory agenda and attacking all these political issues. And I've worked in a lot of libraries, and I don't guess I have a lot of faith in polite conversations in the room making that work. And so I'm wondering, I'm, child of the 60s, and I believe in mass movements. And I remember back when the Creative Commons started, and I thought, well, this is embarrassing to say, but that's not going to do a lot of good. What we need is a revolution. But I really think, actually, that small bit of transparency where you label things is so powerful. And so you're saying that people in the world are, or at least we are, relatively satisfied with what we're getting from Google? Is there some way to make a label to make it transparent what we're not getting to bring more people into the conversation?
Yeah, that's brilliant. I'm not good at thinking that way, so let's talk more about it. I mean, that's exactly what I really hope to unleash is that level of that kind of inquiry, that kind of creativity that comes up with these small efforts that build into something larger.
Do you mind hanging on to the mic for a second? Is it, from a labeling perspective, is that different than, say, a Creative Commons license, which seems to me labeling of roughly this sort?
Can you make some kind of labeling of what we get from Google that explains to people what they're not getting or what's at risk? I'm thinking of labeling.
It's like the inverse Creative Commons license.
So I'm, you know, what I'm really thinking about is labels on food.
Anyone
cans.
From Creative Commons here, by the way, other than Mary? Yes. Oh, Eric, great. You get the mic next.
When, you know, when they started to say how many trans fats or how much salt was in food, you know, people began to make different demands. It just brought way more people into the conversation. That's the thing I was thinking.
Well, and that, I mean, that you needed a political effort to get to that point. You had to actually have a political movement for food safety. That took 100 years, by the way, to get to the point where we actually can find out about how much trans fat's in food. And we're really only in that position now, partially. Right. So it's been 100 years of food safety effort. Wasn't necessarily revolutions in the streets, but it was a series of really smart, devoted people working toward that. I'd say we still have another 100 years to go on food safety, but, you know, better now than 100 years ago.
Eric Saltzman, do you accept cold calls?
Yeah, sure.
Awesome. All right, coming your way.
This is how Facebook got started, right?
Yeah, something like that. So what do you think?
Well, what that made me think of when you said what we're not getting from Google is not so much a label of the rights or the privileges you have in using the work, but more how, from what Siva was describing, of how Google provides the information, how it's ordered, and what's left out. So a whole generation of kids now, I think if it's not the thing that you want to find is provided by Google. And I know that their schools tell them you may not list Google as a site in the research you do, but nevertheless, if it's not in Google, it doesn't exist.
Steve is going to have some terse words for you about the Google generation in a moment, but Eric, so how does this relate, if at all, to what Creative Commons is up to?
Well, Creative Commons has been talking for quite some time now about providing a registry of copyright information, about being able to understand how something is licensed and how it isn't, and basically marking the commons. So in addition to providing licensing so people can make their work available, going beyond that and saying what we really are trying to do is show not just provide an architecture for individuals to make their work available if they wish to, but also to show largely what is available. And we've had discussions about that. We've sought, I would say, funding to do it, but we're not quite there yet. And Google is interested in doing that as well. That would advantage Google as well, because then Google solves some of the problems it has about work that they've put up and do they have the permission to do it. Right now they've got a kind of funky system. They have agreements with some big companies where the information is provided. They look for watermarked material so they can say, understand what permissions they have, and then beyond that they just rely on those and take them.
It's especially important in the YouTube context for them, right?
Particularly.
So Maura or Siva, is this registry that doesn't quite exist but that Eric's talking about from Creative Commons fit into your plan? Is it a necessary piece part effectively to the Human Knowledge Project or the distributed, slightly different but probably consistent form that you're talking about, Maura?
Well, I think that, you know, in looking at the registry, the book rights registry, what would be useful is actually the separation of the two functions in it. So the index function that actually just lists rights status that can be consulted and used and you know, that's separate from the thing that makes determinations and processes kind of licensing payments. And if we could have lots of those, multiple of those, you know, different central, call them, indexes that are just listing that information, that would be very useful. And then if we could have different approved licensing agents that, you know, and especially if they're not under the provisions of the settlement and not under that revenue split, you know, how could that improve our lives? So complicated way of saying, yeah.
Well, and the brilliance of Creative Commons is in its initial modesty, right? That it would provide a toolbox for people who never went to law school like myself to actually navigate the terrain of copyright and and be able to control one's own licensing, which was, I mean, just flashback before Creative Commons. I mean, that's an astounding thing, but it was done with just that effort. And what happened was it sparked an education, a massive education in how copyright works, which has been great for me. So thanks.
Who's hiding in the back? Mic is on its way. Sorry for the momentary delay here. We don't have a second mic, do we? Yeah, we need it. Exactly. Can throw it across the room. This is not a high-ceilinged room for anyone who's not here, so a toss across the room would be bad unless it were a bullet.
Thanks.
Inside, you're on.
So, Maura, I didn't know about this 13 library consortium you mentioned that shares the preservation repository of the Google searches and others. What was
HathiTrust.
It?
HathiTrust. We should talk more about
spell
it.
Spell that for
anyone
me?
Here from HathiTrust, by the way?
H-A-T-H-I. I think it means the symbol is an elephant, so long memory and
okay.
All that.
So I had a question about that then, which is if we're thinking about libraries of the future in the shadow of the settlement, I have wondered about the status of the digitized collections. So Google digitized 5 great libraries, and can we talk a bit about who owns those digital databases and what agreements were made and whether there's a way to change those agreements such that these great libraries will be actually public libraries?
So I wonder, Bob Darton, the university librarian, has got his hand up. So Bob, do you want to come up here, actually? Do you mind? Oh, we've got another one.
I'm happy.
That's great. More is now
fade into the background,
here.
But no. And the HathiTrust is a magnificent enterprise, but it's very limited, and I think it's important to understand its limits. The original idea was to pool together the so-called library digital copies that the libraries get back after Google has scanned their holdings. One of the reasons for this is, of course, Google has no commitment whatsoever to the preservation of its massive digital files. It has an interest in doing it, but it's not committed to future generations the way libraries are. So, led by the University of Michigan Library, the HathiTrust committed itself to basically preservation. But the settlement and the separate agreements made by Google with individual libraries puts extreme limits on what libraries can do with their so-called library digital copies. I mean, imagine your library makes its holdings available for Google to digitize en masse, and then what you get back is a digital copy of your own books, but you can't do much with them. For example, you can't have any of your faculty or students read them. They can be used for certain purposes, and it's not altogether a bad thing, but in one of the versions of the agreement, they would essentially remain dark until the year 2050, which is an eternity in the world of technological change. So I think we, great as a HathiTrust is, we need to somehow find a way to pool these resources that we call the library digital copies, and out of them to create a digital, national, and I hope someday international, digital library. In other words, can we actually use the digitized versions of the material that was in our libraries in the first place? Now, HathiTrust is not, alas, providing a way to do that, but it's the beginning of something, and it's creating a sense of community that I hope will grow. But there are so many legal and other obstacles that it's very unclear as to how we can exploit this opportunity. And all I've heard so far, I mean, I'm in favor of it. Like Alexa, I think, that, you know, okay, let's declare this day one and storm the barricades.
But let me just say that the Human Genome Project did exactly that. It was not a retrospective activity. It was an activity going forward, and that's part of why it succeeded.
Yeah. Well, great. If we can learn from that example, I'm all for it. What worries me in the discussion is we're all saying, let us rely on public authorities, and we will be out-lobbied by Google. I mean, they now have a major operation in Washington, D.C. So I'm We need to change copyright law, I agree, and we need to change a lot of things, but if this is day one, what precise steps are we going to take? I gather that's on the agenda for the rest of the day.
Well, I think if we leave today without having a sense of that, or at least several efforts, we won't have done a good job here. But I also think, I've heard a bunch so far, but Siva, why don't you jump in?
So let me build on the issues that Bob brought up about the library copy. Early on in the discussions of Google Book Search 5 years ago or so, many of the concerns that I raised and other people raised about the privatization of this this process were sort of cavalierly dismissed by the mention that, oh, the library gets a copy. Well, it turns out that what the library gets is not always all that useful or accessible, largely because at this point, I think there are more than 25 U.S. libraries involved in the project and a number of, is it 30 at this point? And then I don't even know how many global libraries there are involved, but there are a number around the world. And they have different contracts, not individual contracts, but sort of different versions of contracts as they, like the original five have a different version of contracts from the next set and the next set and the next set. At my university, the University of Virginia, the university administrators' councils have forbidden the library from downloading their copies. And they give no indication about when the library is allowed to have access to these copies. And the reason is pretty obvious. It's a huge liability risk. The settlement does not include the University of Virginia. The University of Virginia is not a party to the settlement, is not insulated from liability from the settlement. There was massive copying of works from the University of Virginia of copyrighted works, and nothing in the settlement and nothing in the case law protects them. In fact, it's sort of a totally new out there notion of massive copying of copyrighted material that has no, I mean, the lawyers are just baffled by this notion. Like, what is the liability risk for downloading this stuff from Google? And they're not willing to let the librarians have at this stuff. So it's pretty much useless, and I can't see a way out.
They're actually baffled, Siva. They're worried. Right. I mean, it's an affirmative concern.
They're worried because they're baffled. I mean, they're both, right? They're not baffled in the sense that they're baffled because we're all baffled. That's actually, I mean, if you think through the copyright implications of the copying of thousands, maybe tens of thousands of copyrighted books from the University of Virginia that we essentially asked a third party, might as well have been Kinko's, to go do for us, and then we're going to take them and use them in-house at the very moment that public universities are being sued by the publishing industry over electronic reserves, and we don't know how that case is going to go. So the settlement has no bearing on the University of Virginia. The other lawsuit, the future of electronic reserves is up in the air right now. The notion that libraries can actually enjoy things like first sale and interlibrary loan are pretty much on the precipice. Everything is coming down hard on libraries right now, and we can't pretend for a moment that the library copy matters in this environment. Plus, this quality is horrible. We don't want to build the next century's global universal library based on the copies that Google's made. You've got handprints in the middle of a bunch of pages.
For those not in the room, there were a lot of librarians nodding after the quality comment. Important body language in the room. Who else? Please.
Dee Magnoni, Olin College of Engineering. I agree, but not knowing if it's on. as you were discussing the Human Knowledge Project, I was sort of visioning the suffrage, the women's suffrage movement. You know, it took forever and it was very messy. You had to get people involved that worked all day long and had to go home and feed families, and they didn't see how they could spend time on that, and yet it was critically important for them to get involved. But then the conversation turned a little bit and talked about the food safety movement, a completely different movement, solved by a small, relatively small number of people. And I wonder what you think the architecture might be, because it's two very, very different approaches to solving this problem and different people getting involved.
I'm agnostic on that, on what form. I know that, so Bob brought up the notion of, trying to out-lobby Google. I don't think that's at all what we need to be thinking about. It's not about the short game at all. It really is about changing public minds over a period of time. period of years, motivating in small ways, but with a larger sense, a larger agenda, and moving piecemeal towards something grander and larger. But some of these boulders are huge. Some of these mountains are huge, like copyright. And you know, look, Google might be a partner in that one day, and on some other issue may be opposed to the Human Knowledge Project on some other issue, and Google's fine with that, just like every other company's fine with that. You know, Google teams up with AT&T on some issues and opposes them on other issues. It's just the way it goes. So, you know, but I don't want to predetermine the nature of a movement. If I were any good at that, I would have a different job. I just want to basically plant the seed of such a vision and see if people who do movements well can run with it. I don't want a year one, though. I don't like a French Revolution situation. Uh-huh. That would be horrible. With respect, of course. But,
you know. So there's a question that I wonder if Bob or others can answer without violating appropriate NDAs. Eric Hellman, are you in the room? Is asking what exactly can we do with the library copies? And from an engineering perspective, not interested in what we can't do, but what we can. Is that something you can talk to at all? I think Bob needs it. Oh. Sorry. Eric can ask more if he wants, but it seemed fairly clear in his 140 characters.
There are useful things we can do with the library digital copy. If one of our books is lost or damaged, disappears some way, in principle, we can use the library digital copy to replace it. However, the settlement requires that we first make sure that this book isn't available on the market anywhere else. So there are limits to it, and that's typical, I would say, about the tone of the settlement. But that's something. Another thing we can do is some kinds of what the settlement calls non-consumptive research. So it would be possible to do quantitative studies of the evolution of language based on your library digital copy. But of course, how valid is that statistical base for this kind of research? The great hope is the statistical base being created in the two research centers that we hope will exist, and maybe there will be a third.
If the settlement is approved, and
if it's approved, that's right.
This is if you're looking at the decision tree, this is an if the settlement is approved, and then as is, there are two of these research centers set up at libraries, which may or may not be, I guess it doesn't necessarily have to be a library, but may or may not be a participating library.
That's correct. But you cannot use the library digital copy for electronic resources for making things available in courses or anything that we associate with fair use. In fact, you could argue the settlement has been a defeat for fair use in many ways. So I would say, yes, the library digital copy is worth having, but also, and this is a point that Siva made, there it's surrounded with tremendous barriers or requirements concerning litigation. So if you make any move that would in the slightest way violate the terms of the library Google agreement, you could expose your university to litigation in all sorts of ways. And I think there are almost more pages about the commitments to protecting the university from litigation in the settlement than there are about anything else. So at Harvard as well, the university councils are obsessed with the danger of litigation, and that's one of the reasons that the library digital copy will be so extremely limited in the way we can make use of it.
I'll give it back to Eric, but I do want to say on behalf of general counsels at universities, the baffled that Siva notes, I think there is gray here, right? There's stuff that we don't know. There are pending cases. There's the challenge, I think it's Irvine that's been doing the course reserves and so forth. And as we go forward with various things like a scan and deliver project here at Harvard University, the council's office is very much at the table with us designing that, and I think is helping us to find what are the places that are reasonably safe ground, but not clearly not entirely safe ground, in the sense of doing what lawyers do, which is assess risk, right? They say we have an X billion dollar endowment, fewer dollars than we used to, and as we do this, we get a certain benefit for taking this particular risk, but it's against the backdrop of not knowing exactly what it's going to be. So I think it would be a mistake to characterize Harvard's general counsel's office as being particularly obsessed in this way. I actually think that they've been helpful to us in finding good parts of this, and I think there's a constructive role that lawyers can play in general counsel's office this year.
I didn't mean baffled pejoratively, right? Because look, I mean, astrophysicists are baffled every day, and that's what drives them to work, right? I mean, being baffled is actually a really good starting, that's a healthy intellectual starting point for a lot of different things. So I didn't mean it in the sense that they were not engaged with it or on top of things. They're legitimately flustered by the level of potential liability and the complexity of this particular setup, and it's one that had implications that have surprised them in the wake of the settlement. So that's all I meant by it. Certainly not.
No, I think it's right. I just wanted to get the context.
I don't want to do that either. I mean, I think that the university council has been tremendously helpful. For one thing, those of us who are mere civilians can't understand the settlement. And I mean, the people like James Grimmelman, who's here, I think, who've been wonderfully helpful. But also, the council interprets future possibilities.
There's no doubt.
And you can't think your way through the policies without the council's help. So I want to, pay tribute to the council. But if you read the settlement, read all of the provisos concerning litigation and potential punishment if you step over various lines that are meant to prevent litigation. So I think a lot of libraries will find themselves not wanting to be participating partners in the Google settlement if it's approved for that reason.
Yep.
There are various roles which libraries can play, a cooperating library, a participating library, etc. And these roles depend on the degree of exposure to litigation. So you've got litigation as a crucial factor, I think, in the evolution of this new environment.
No doubt. So legal risk is plainly a problem. I think we can all say that universities have not been profiles in courage in all of this in terms of moving the ball forward and fair use and otherwise, and we ought to be more. Fair use is use it or lose it, and we need to do more of this, but I think we have generally been cautious about it. I just don't think we lay all the blame at the feet of the general counsel's office. But anyway, look to ourselves, right, in this other spirit. Eric.
Just for me, a point of information from Professor Darnton or James Grimmelman. For public domain works that were copied from your library or from other libraries, do you have a digital copy? May you make them available to the public, do whatever you want, or what are the limitations on those?
Well, just briefly, as I understand it, we cannot use our digital copy, even of works in the public domain. James, if he's here somewhere, I hope he can correct me if I'm wrong. But after all, the digital copies of these works belong to Google. Now, you can have access to them, of course, through the internet. But I don't believe that we can use our own digital copies of public domain works.
James, are you going to take the bait here?
I'm looking it up.
All right. James is looking up. Now, Bob, I mean, I think there is, this may be in an NDA zone too, just in the sense that we do, as a university, have an original agreement with Google for our phase one work and digitization, which, and that is set out in several paragraphs there. I'm just not positive what we can say, so it's probably sensible that we hold off for the time being. But if James has an answer from the settlement, maybe we'll go there. Second.
I just had a follow-up question. In the agreements that were made public, Google is committed to providing the public domain copies for public access in perpetuity, aren't they? Where you can go now and download those copies?
I don't think anything's in perpetuity and commitment. That's for sure in my reading of the settlement. James is gonna give us an answer.
I mean, the key to that is through Google,
right?
And so here's why that's important. If you're interacting with the library catalog of the University of Virginia, and actually every other university library in this country, that catalog page is not putting a cookie in your browser, but that catalog probably has a link to Google Book Search, so you can look at the book online through Google Book Search. And if you click on that, you're immediately sent to Google and a cookie is placed in your browser. And no point is there a warning. The university does not warn you that you're entering Googleville, and at that point you will be monitored. And this is a really crucial problem, and this is why the distinction is important. When you're in Google land, you are serving Google. When you're in university land, you are working within the norms and rules and regulations of the university, which have been well forged over a couple centuries. And that simple click seems so innocent and yet has such profound consequences. The other implication of that is the extent to which researchers can or cannot use the file itself to do analysis of the text in a way that they would choose, right? So what you download in PDF form from Google has certain limitations, certain data built into it. And the question, there have been all these questions, and I get a bunch of different answers about like what level of OCR data is given to the libraries, what level of OCR data is then available to researchers through the libraries. So it really is, in many cases, a researcher question, not just a reader question, for what can happen with the university's copy.
On this point, as we go, we'll go to Sarah Cortez in a second. There's a tweet from someone named Senor Prego, who seems to be in London, not in the room, is that true? Who says, is noting the obsession with the danger of litigation, also threatening to cripple online journalism, which is an interesting parallel. We at the Berkman Center have something called the Citizen Media Law Project, which is meant to be clarity to citizen journalism, journalists on law. Seems to me one of the things we might put on our list of things to do would be for libraries to have a CMLP-like thing with respect to the settlement and otherwise, since we've got some very basic questions that seem fairly hard to answer. So for funders in the room or out there, maybe that's a good thing to support as well. Go ahead, sir.
As an IT implementer, my concerns go immediately to some of the things you raised earlier, Siva, about quality of searches and things like that. People like myself and others at Google will be responsible for making sure that the trains run on time. People will become, highly dependent on this in a very short period of time. And all the other concerns that have been raised around other Google applications, whereby they offer them for free, people become highly dependent on them in a short time, and there's really no other alternative. What are some of the questions and concerns and ways that issues could be raised around quality control for the Google service, making sure that it remains online, with millions of people becoming dependent on the availability of certain books? If it's not available, what redress is there? And similar issues to credit reporting agencies, where credit agencies ignored for years and years and years people who had serious complaints about the quality of their data. I see similar issues happening with Google Book Search, whereby authors, who never appear in search results, their concerns fall on deaf ears for years, other types of things. So that's really my question.
Well, that's my question too. I'm an author whose books are way down in the Google Book
Search.
search any of the terms, you think my books are going to show up, and they never show up. Neither do Larry's. They're way down there. Like, most of the time I do a search for copyright law just to see what comes up. We get this brilliant book from 1912, which is the best book about copyright in 1912. And it's a book I had to read when I was doing my dissertation. And it's really a great book, but it's not what you would want to read now on that. So, no, that now look, Google has a feedback mechanism built into it. You can express to Google your concerns about scan quality. You can express to Google your concerns about search results. It's a cumbersome process. It's unclear the extent to which the feedback actually works through. I have heard of many cases in which librarians have found bad images, reported it to Google, and they've been replaced with better images. One of the reasons that Google is working with so many libraries is to get some level of redundancy, so that if they have a better copy, they can then push that farther up into the search results. But again, it's a black box. It's a situation that... thank goodness Google cares as much as it does, because it would be a worse situation if it didn't. The real question, though, in the long term is, how long will Google care, under what conditions will it care, and what happens when it's clear over time that Google Book Search is a money loser, as YouTube is a money loser? What happens to it over time as things get tighter at a company like that? For that, there's no consumer feedback, and actually we're not consumers, we're products of Google, so it's not even consumer feedback, user feedback that matters in that situation. So for that, you can address that question with one about standards, either standards enforced through consortia of private groups that are doing this sort of thing, where they adhere to certain standards and feedback mechanisms, or through the law.
So James, are you ready for the mic? I would just say, as James gets it, two things that are, as I read the settlement, fairly clear. Google does not give a particularly strong standard for quality, right? And does not commit to in perpetuity archival stuff. That neither of those are things.
I do. I mean, that's the thing. I wish libraries had brought up quality issues day one, and it frustrated me that they didn't.
Well, Eric Saltzman makes this point that one of the problems with the process has been that though libraries were certainly involved in aspects of negotiation, at least bilaterally, there wasn't somebody standing in the room for these. That's a critique of the settlement process, made fairly plain. James Grimmelman, the expert in many respects on all of this, please shoot.
So I basically went back to the Wisconsin agreements, which are relatively representative of Google's agreements with the various libraries, which I found from the public index website, their archive of all relevant documents. The essentials of what the libraries can do with their digital copies of books in the public domain is that they can make them available for scholarly research purposes and other academic purposes, but nothing that would come close to being a commercial use that would compete with Google. So in particular, they are allowed to use them for scholarly research and academic purposes, but they have to take fairly strong affirmative steps to keep third parties from being able to download them or download them in bulk in ways that could ever be used commercially. Now, after the settlement was announced, Google started renegotiating deals with all of the libraries. So the amended version announced about a month ago, extends libraries' rights, gives them a little more ability to send these copies to other academic institutions for all of these uses, but again, subject to the same restrictions that you get a copy, you need to take responsibility to keep it from getting into commercial hands. And 20 years from the date that this goes into effect, the libraries are able to start giving copies to people who will do anything with them. So you can start making commercial uses, just unless you're making commercial uses that actually compete with the businesses Google is in under the settlement, hosting and search.
Very helpful. James, anything else? You have been listening along. Anything else you'd care to comment on at this stage, or perhaps the initial proposals by Siva or Maura?
No, I'm going to have some thoughts about that later in the day, but I think the sort of flow of ideas about frameworks for moving forward and what the issues on the table are things people in this room actually have better grasps on than I do.
Hard to believe that's true, but thank you. Who else? Looking for the mic. Please.
I'm a librarian for Japanese materials, and I just want to throw a very different perspective that Japanese National Library single-handedly digitized Japanese monographs up to 1920s and freely accessible right now, which is not equivalent to Google book search because there is no great search capability for text. But now, this year, this National Library received 100 times larger budget from previous year for digitization project. So now they changed the copyright law because that National Library is a copyright sort of enforcing entity. That National Library can do digitized copyrighted materials. That this, so it's not illegal to do that for them to do. Then we don't know what happened to access, but this is current situation. So I just wonder, this is one model or alternative to Google Book Project?
It's an excellent, excellent point. I want to bring it back to Steve and push on the global aspect of your proposal as well, but extremely important, I think, both to bring into play this question of what are national libraries doing with respect to their cultural heritage and so forth. I spent the last week at an international librarians conference, and the head of one national library or person responsible for this in Northern Europe was mentioning that they were entering into an agreement, I think, with ProQuest to digitize all of their things and to do it as a basically a semi-commercial deal, which struck me as obviously quite a different arrangement than what the Japanese government has decided to do. I think all of this is crucial to be saying we're not doing this alone in the U.S. There are real concerns about the settlement with respect to international works, of course, under U.S. copyright, but also that any of this discussion needs to be in the context of what are national libraries doing, which traditionally, in many ways, I think, have this burden, both of preservation and providing access to the core aspects of knowledge in our society. Siva, can I push it over to you with respect to folding this into your
overall? So, I mean, we know that there are dozens of both national libraries and university libraries around the world engaged in digitization projects, as there were in the United States for the last 20 years. But they've largely been disconnected and haphazard. And one of the great virtues of looking at the precedent of the Human Genome Project is the extent to which coordination of standards and access and databases became essential once the Human Genome Project ramped up its funding and its metabolism in the wake of private competition. So the key then is making sure that all of these digitization projects around the world agree on standards, agree on image formats, agree on metadata, agree on searchability, and have something close to a universal search project attached to it, so that stuff doesn't get lost in corners. You can't just search for Ukrainian works if you're in the Ukraine. There are, at the state level in this country, a number of state digitization projects, I know of in Wisconsin, for instance, in which access is largely restricted to IP numbers that sit within the state of Wisconsin, which is deeply unfortunate, to put it mildly. But it's based on the notion that Wisconsin taxpayers paid for this and they should get it, and Illinois taxpayers didn't, and they don't get it. That ultimately defeats the purpose of what we should be going for. So one of the reasons I would like to have this global long-term conversation is not so much about political, it is about political movements, it is about funding, but it's also about standards. Because we really need to figure out file formats that are going to last 1,000 years. We need to figure out metadata standards that work for everybody across the board. And we have to make sure that the situation, that these vast archives are not balkanized by states as much as they are now balkanized by private actors.
Excellent. Maura, in many respects, your project is all about this process and the sewing together of this and creating of the platforms, human and otherwise. Do you want to reflect on that at all?
I was just thinking about what Siva was saying and saying, you know, that's why we think that the interoperability of these repositories is the most important thing. And we have all of these standalone repositories or collaborative repositories, but they can't talk to each other yet. And these are exactly the kinds of problems that we see people working on now. But it's just going to be a matter of time and attention to that to keep it going. Going back to the biodiversity heritage model, the European partners of DHL have multiple repositories around Europe that they're using. So the content is flowing freely there, and that's a start. That's a way to make a step.
Couple last comments before we go to break. Yes, please.
I also want to make sure we include in this conversation a discussion about things that aren't digitized yet and things that didn't go into the Google project, because there's a tremendous body of work that's not included there. And, I'm curious about the settlement. My understanding, and I very well may be wrong about this, is the settlement doesn't include books that have the images within books. We're just talking about the text, so we're not actually getting complete works. And the other thing is, I don't think it includes serial titles and journals and things like that. So there's actually a huge body of work that Google did digitize that we're also not getting through this settlement.
Did or may not yet have as well, right?
Right, but I think we need to make sure we include those in the discussion.
Very helpful. A couple last comments pre-break, please.
Melinda Koyanis, retired after 30 years in book publishing. Welcome. And in terms of the standards going forward for a human knowledge project, one of the things I've been concerned about is replacing the traditional methods of citation for attribution and provenance of works in any kind of universal digital database that's going to be accessible that allows user interactivity and changing of mixing and matching.
Very helpful. Siva, do you want to respond?
I'm with you. I mean, I'm living in that challenge right now. I mean, so many of the documents I'm trying to cite have very slippery ways. There was one, at one point, I really needed to get a quote from Audacity of Hope, Obama's book, because he visited Google and has all these lovely things to say about Google. And I needed it like right away. It wasn't on Google Book Search in full text. And so I couldn't find the quote in Google Book Search. Libraries, copies were all checked out. And I don't think I had the car that day. So I couldn't get to Barnes & Noble to buy it. So I downloaded it to my Kindle and then just went, oh, I can't cite it now because there's no page number, you know, so.
And then it disappeared from your Kindle.
Yeah, right.
Mysterious. Great. So I want to give Maura and Siva a last word. Does anybody want one last question from the group? Glad to give it. Awesome. No. Maura, then Siva, then I'm going to say one brief thing, and then we'll go to break. So Maura, last words.
Last words. I'm glad we're talking about the real framework to get this done, because I think, you know, thinking of the ideal, we have to get these practical steps. So I'm delighted to keep learning from everyone here, and thank you.
Thank you. Siva.
Right on.
All right, right on. So let me just do a two-minute recap of what I heard here, and maybe we can kind of stick it on a wiki somewhere and use it to move forward. What I heard was I didn't quite expect as much similarity in what Siva and Maura said, but there's a lot, I think, which is the notion, maybe it's Alexa's frame, that we should start here. And yes, we may not have to deal with the settlement, but there's a lot that we can do either way, on either of these branches, that there is the notion of a broad-based common global effort in the human knowledge project sphere, right? We may or may not talk the exact contours of what Siva adopts, but that there's something there, and that Maura's notion of knowledge created in lots of different communities then stitched together may be consistent with that umbrella kind of concept. Bob said, so what next? I'm going to try to answer that from what I heard here, that there are lots of individual pieces, next steps that might go along. Plainly, Maura says there are lots of projects underway, but we need more projects. I'm heartened by the comment about national libraries in some parts of the world, and then you might accept that there are other national libraries not yet participating. Take seriously this concern. We need to be focused on the bodies of knowledge that are not yet digitized, either through the settlement or otherwise. I see Peter Suber sitting there and immediately think open access and how this might be part of the same story about getting more materials digitized. Even if we do, though, there are lots of very specific cross-cutting platform type issues that would need to be addressed, and I'm sure this is in the chapter in Siva's forthcoming book, but things that push at interoperability and standardization. Some of this has to do, of course, with search and common notions around that. Metadata standards, file formats, systems of citation, all of these things seem like common efforts, and we all know, we could probably all say in our respective fields, here's an effort toward that, but there's not necessarily a single large-scale effort to do it. We've heard about a labeling system as potentially helpful, labeling with respect to what's not in a search or what rights you don't have in certain works, the sort of inverse Creative Commons license notion in my inexact phrasing of it. Potentially a registry of works that is global in nature, maybe something that Creative Commons will eventually get funded to do or maybe not. We've also heard, too, about the potential need for an infrastructure around the legal issues, potentially some form of public support for answering some of these key questions about what libraries and others can do with different works. So I see a fairly explicit work plan or game plan. We may disagree with that work plan, but there's a lot that one might do. Obviously, the contours of it and what you might press on might differ depending on what happens this fall in a courtroom in New York City, but more on that to come. So please join me in thanking these two great panelists, Maura and Suba, and all of you.